Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Justin Glau, an independent journalist who examines the Trump administration's decision to use Charlie Kirk's murder as a pretext to repress the free speech rights of the regime's liberal left political opponents. Katherine Hines, founder of the Connecticut Visibility Brigade, and her attorney Margaret Donovan, who talk about Hines' arrest for engaging in free speech, opposing the Trump regime's authoritarian conduct and policies. And Madison Shepherd, with the group Fridays for Future Cape Cod, who discusses the Make Billionaires Pay International Mobilization for Climate Justice, happening in New York City and across the U.S., September 19th to the 21st. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since early spring, the Trump administration has been steadily expanding its military footprint in the Philippines as part of its broader strategy against China. With little public scrutiny or accountability, Washington is now preparing to deploy a second Typhoon missile system to the Philippines capable of reaching nuclear-armed China. Experts and U.S. officials have widely acknowledged that the confrontational policy could bring the U.S. into direct conflict with Beijing. The U.S. military presence in the Philippines has long been opposed by the Filipino people, with mass movements successfully pressuring the government to close American bases in the early 1990s. That victory came after decades of struggle against U.S.-backed dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Today, with Marcos's son, Bongbong Marcos Jr., back in power, the U.S. is again strengthening its alliance with Manila. Mong Palatino, the Secretary General of a Philippines Progressive Civil Society Coalition, told The Intercept the U.S. missile system endangers our population and it undermines our security. Growing opposition to the Philippines-U.S. military alliance comes from many sectors, including fishermen, environmentalists, and labor unions. In late April, President Trump signed an executive order to fast-track applications for deep-sea mining that he said will create a robust domestic supply chain for critical minerals derived from seabed resources to support economic growth, reindustrialization, and military preparedness. Trump described seabed mining as both an economic and national security imperative necessary to counter China. However, the International Seabed Authority, or ISA, established under the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, is the only organization that can legally approve mining in international waters. The ISA's Secretary General, Leticia Reese de Carvalho, responded to Trump, stating that this order can only refer to resources found on the U.S. seabed and ocean floor because everything beyond is the common heritage of humankind. Prior to the president's order, more than 900 leading scientists and marine policy experts from over 70 countries had signed a statement calling for a pause on deep-sea mining until more scientific data was obtained to prove that such activity would not harm the marine environment. 33 countries, including Canada, France, the United Kingdom, and a number of Pacific Island countries, are also calling for a moratorium or outright ban on deep-sea mining. Union activists in the deep red state of Utah mobilized to collect 300,000 signatures calling for a referendum to overturn a legislative ban on public employees' right to collective bargaining. Across Utah, 20 unions participated in the campaign in a state with one of the lowest union density rates in the nation. The massive signature-gathering effort was part of a months-long fight against Utah's House Bill 267, which, if not overturned, would become one of the nation's most repressive bans on public sector unions. The bill bans certain union activity on public property and bars public workers who join unions from getting pensions. If, however, the November 2026 referendum is approved by voters, it will overturn the anti-union legislation. The bill's sponsors are members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, whose right-wing labor policy handbook has served as a model for anti-union bills across the U.S. A similar crackdown is happening at the national level, too, as President Trump issued an executive order in March that stripped federal union workers of their collective bargaining rights. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the aftermath of the horrendous assassination of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, the latest incident of political violence in the U.S., there's rising concern that increasing polarization may spin out of control and claim more lives. This is particularly dangerous in a nation where the population has easy access to all manner of guns, pistols, long guns, and semi-automatic weapons of war, unlike any other nation in the world. Kirk, who was founder of the group Turning Point USA, focused on youth outreach, a Christian nationalist and an ally of Donald Trump, expressed many controversial views on race, gender, and sexual identity, including his condemnation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as an anti-white weapon. Although divided on his message, politicians, activists, and commentators of all political persuasions unconditionally condemned the act of violence that killed Kirk, who leaves behind a wife and two children. But unlike most politicians who condemned all incidents of political violence, whether coming from the left or right, Donald Trump singled out leftist groups as being responsible for recent violence, saying in an interview, quote, "Radicals on the right oftentimes are radical because they don't want to see crime. But according to most studies, terrorists inspired by right-wing ideology are responsible for more than half of all recent deaths attributed to political violence." Your reporter spoke with Justin Glau, an independent journalist and editor of the American Doom newsletter. Here he examines the response to Kirk's assassination and Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Attorney General Pam Bondi's threat to use Kirk's murder as a pretext to repress the free speech rights of the regime's perceived political enemies on the left.
I have been surprised to see sort of what I'm considering the mainstreaming of Charlie Kirk after his really unfortunate and troubling and horrific death. That stands on its own as a horrific act and a horrific development and is terrible for his family and his fans and his loved ones and supporters. But the fact still stands that in any normal world, Charlie Kirk was not a moderate political actor. Charlie Kirk was, by definition, a right-wing extremist who held what I believe and what I hope most Americans would say are some pretty extreme views, whether it comes to gay rights, women's rights, minority rights, things like the power of the executive branch. This was a guy who, like a lot of people in the Trump administration, essentially believed that because they are conservative and they are Republican, that their rights supersede everyone else's rights. And like, to me, that's a fundamentally extreme position. So it has been surprising to see even mainstream publications and outlets like New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, Washington Post, the New York Times, acting as if Charlie Kirk was a moderate political actor when his own words and his own positions do not reflect that.
Thank you for that, Justin. There's been a lot of really disturbing ripples that have come out after Charlie Kirk's murder, and one was covered by the Washington Post over the weekend, where Trump said on Friday morning on Fox News that, quote, "the radicals on the left are the problem, and they're vicious, and they're horrible, and they're politically savvy.
We've had other administration officials speak about a broad plan that the administration has to focus on public speech and rhetoric, declaring that those who speak in violent terms about Trump and his allies will face consequences. Some suggested a more expansive campaign, calling out school teachers and college instructors who've made public statements criticizing Kirk since his death, and promising to deport non-citizens who do the same. Donald Trump himself recently said that he was calling on prosecutors to file racketeering charges against George Soros, one of the Democratic Party's biggest donors. Trump and his allies have long claimed without evidence that Mr. Soros foments violent protests. What's your level of concern, Justin, that Charlie Kirk's murder will be exploited and used as a pretext to crack down on speech, political speech, that this administration dislikes?
As high of a level of concern as one can get. You know, the Trump administration was already on this path before Kirk's killing. I don't know where their investigation, quote unquote, stands into Act Blue, the major Democratic fundraising outfit. But, you know, they had said several months ago that they were going to investigate them for some type of, you know, criminal wrongdoing. You know, they have already been weaponizing the powers of the state to crack down on immigrants or visa holders who, you know, make political statements that the administration disagrees with. And it wasn't only but a few months ago that we saw that with, you know, the two students, one from Tufts University and then the kid from, I think, NYU, that, you know, Marco Rubio basically just said, I don't like what you're saying, so we are arresting you. You know, so like this just pours gasoline on that fire. And the way that I think about it is, I think this is going to look something, it's going to look similar to what happened after 9/11, which is this expansion of the surveillance state that we saw with things like the Patriot Act and, you know, of course, the whole NSA surveillance debacle that Edward Snowden exposed. You know, I think it looks something like that, where, you know, a horrific event, in that case, September 11th, and in this case, Charlie Kirk's killing, is used, like you said, as pretext to further clamp down on political speech and rights of people that are against the administration. Obviously, what's, I think, a little bit more troubling here than in that instance, perhaps, is that, you know, the majority of Americans saw 3,000 of their fellow countrymen die on September 11th and said, you know, if we need to make a sacrifice of some of our civil liberties, then we're willing to do that. Whereas this was the killing of a person who is extremely popular if you look at the amount of Americans who voted for Trump by about, what, I don't know, 35% of the country. So we're now in a situation where our rights and our civil liberties are going to be clamped down upon because of the death of somebody who, like I said before, was frankly a political extremist. And I think that that is makes this more troubling than what happened after 9/11 in some ways.
That was Justin Glau, an independent journalist and editor of the American Doom newsletter. Find more news and commentary on America's political violence crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past 4 years, the number of visibility brigades, groups of progressive activists who hold up banners with political messages on highway overpasses, has grown from one to more than 200 in 41 states. Yet a participant has been arrested in only one place, Greater New Haven, Connecticut, where many towns and cities along the Connecticut shoreline are under the same state police jurisdiction. The Connecticut Visibility Brigade was launched earlier this year. Its volunteers hold up 25-foot vinyl banners with various political messages that mostly target policies, not individuals, such as do not obey in advance and resist tyranny. The group also displays banners that respond to more specific issues of the day. But in July and again in August, a Connecticut state trooper arrested Catherine Hines, the founder and leader of the Connecticut Brigade, on 3 misdemeanor charges. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hines and her attorney, Margaret Donovan, about the brigade's mission, what it has accomplished, and where things stand as Hines heads to court to face charges in 2 different towns on September 19th and September 30th.
Like many folks in the country, I'm pretty upset, angry, and outraged at the infringement and of our rights and the creeping fascism in our government. And so starting on February 14th, a small group and I went up on a bridge in Brantford with a sign that we had made out of poster boards, and we were there for an hour. We're highly aware of what's called the distraction issue, which is always, you know, people always say, but aren't you distracting? And it's like, distraction is in the eye of the beholder. It's up to the driver to pay attention to their driving. And that's kind of been proved out by the research that's been done specifically around digital billboards so that traffic could see us. And this is a phenomena that's been happening across the country, started in New Jersey. And I'd seen it in New Jersey and talked to the guy who was organizing it there. His name's Dana Glazer. He gave me a lot of tips and a lot of framing of the legal issues or regulatory issues. And we felt really comfortable in Connecticut going out and doing this. So the very first time we went up, we were interrupted by a state trooper, Joshua Jackson. Trooper Jackson came up and said, "You can't do this." And we said, "Well, we cleared it with the Brantford Police Department. We feel that we can do this." And he said, "You can't because you can't fix the sign on the fencing." And I asked, "Well, if we hold the signs, would we be okay?" And he said, "Yes." We weren't deterred because we felt like, okay, this is a one-off. This is one trooper. And so we kept going up on the bridges, both in Brantford and West Haven, during rush hour in the morning and the afternoon. And we cleared it with both town police departments. And we felt that our messaging was being received by both sides of any aisle or, you know, any geographic lines. People are angry, too. And seeing us on the bridge waving with the signs was reinforcing that people aren't alone. And it really helps people feel more empowered and more hopeful. And that's what we were aiming for. We very rarely mention Trump's name. I don't even like saying it. You know, we talk about the issues. We've used a lot of Timothy Snyder quotes. And people get it. And if they don't get it, a lot of them will stop on the bridge and say, "What does that mean, no kings?" And so we're educating as well. And we're very respectful. You know, we're not getting in the way of traffic. The town cops, again, would drive by and wave. A lot of the troopers would drive by and wave.
Attorney Margaret Donovan, why don't you weigh in here?
This is just about one arrest at this point, right? This is the July 19th arrest. We knew that she had a criminal case, and our firm doesn't always do criminal work, but when we do, we take on the occasional pro bono case if it's meaningful, if it's impactful, and if it's something important for the public and for us to do. And this was directly on point with those principles. So what I saw sort of looking over just the very basic facts of the case was somebody who was part of a group engaging in what is core protected speech, right? This is the First Amendment, the courts have said, is at its zenith when you have groups that are protesting on political matters, peacefully protesting, and having the exact effect that Catherine just outlined, right? Like, you are speaking to the public. That is the purpose of a protest. It is a successful protest. It is a successful form of political speech. If you can actually have that effect and that influence on your audience, right? So that's what I saw happening. And then she gets hit with criminal trespass 2, unauthorized signs on a highway, and breach of peace 2. All misdemeanor charges. Unauthorized signs is actually a violation. So low-level charges. Obviously, Ms. Hines has no criminal history. This is not really a case that I think most prosecutors would want to sort of throw the book at her, right? Then I got a call at 6 in the morning on August 8th, and it was from Catherine. And she was telling me that there was a state trooper at her door, pounding on the door. And I could hear in the background, I was on the phone with her. It was Trooper Jackson, spoiler alert. She had not let him in yet. I could hear him pounding on the door. And he had come to arrest her again for the exact same offenses that I had just appeared in court for her just days earlier. That was Trooper Jackson trying to have a show of force against a peaceful protester. And that should be ringing alarm bells for everybody. Not because she was back out protesting, not because she had committed, you know, new crimes, but because he had spent basically several weeks looking through her Facebook page and trying to stick it to her.
Catherine Hines, is there anything you want to add?
it makes me sad because we've been shut down. You know, there's no one right at this point. This could change on the daily, but no one in our group right now who is comfortable going back up. There are five or six other groups in Connecticut, and they're still protesting.
That was Catherine Hines, founder and leader of the Connecticut Visibility Brigade, and her attorney, Margaret Donovan, with the firm Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter. Learn more about this case, the Connecticut and National Visibility Brigades, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 20th, as world leaders gather in New York City for the United Nations annual General Assembly meeting, thousands of activists across a range of social movements will take to the streets for what they expect will be the largest mass mobilization since the No King's Day protests across the U.S. in June. A coalition of more than 100 groups are organizing the September protest actions, dubbed Make Billionaires Pay in New York City, and nearly 200 other locations across the U.S., linking the need to address the climate crisis, migrant justice, and gender equity. The three central demands of the action are: shut down billionaires to fund our future, shut down fascists to protect migrants in the global majority, and shut down polluters to defend Mother Earth. The protest comes as the Trump regime, since January, has been engaged in dismantling dozens of landmark federal environmental, clean air, clean water, and climate regulations on an apocalyptic scale. Your reporter spoke with Madison Shepherd, youth climate activist and lead organizer with Fridays for Future Cape Cod, who talks about the Make Billionaires Pay International Mobilization for Climate Justice happening September 19th to the 21st.
Make Billionaires Pay, we have three main demands that are: shut down billionaires to fund our future, shut down fascists to protect migrants and the global majority, and to shut down polluters and defend Mother Earth. We are putting a lot of emphasis in New York City because Trump world leaders and their billionaire allies will be gathering in New York City for the weekend for the UN General Assembly and the New York Climate Week. And we're putting big emphasis on September 20th because that is also the global climate strike. It happens every year. And we are having a mass mobilization march through New York City, where we are going to be marching through to show our opposition to the tax cuts for the wealthy and big oil handouts that drive both oppression and climate chaos. And if you'd like to join us, that we will be on Park Avenue in Manhattan between 46th Street and 49th Street at 12 p.m. this Saturday, September 20th.
Madison, I wanted to check in with you about the coalition of groups that have come together to sponsor the protest in New York City, but also the other gatherings that will be taking place in other locations. Who's part of the coalition? I know labor organizations, environmental groups, religious denominations, but there's a lot more. Maybe you can run down some of the groups that you're working with in preparation for the New York City protest and the other locations too.
So we have 180 plus endorsers from across the country, and those are all groups that are actively going to show up or are helping set this up. But there are four main groups that are contributing to this movement and this event, which is 350, DRUM, Climate Defenders, and Women's March. And they are a mix of both climate groups and human rights groups.
Madison, you know, I wondered if you might run down some of the things that you're most concerned about that the Trump administration has done in terms of the environment and climate since they took office in January. And that's in addition to immediately withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord. In March, the Trump administration announced plans to repeal dozens of environmental protections, including limits on soot, air toxics, mercury, and other cancer-causing pollutions from cars, trucks, power plants, the oil and gas industry, iron and steel manufacturing, and other industrial sources. It seemed just like a wholesale deregulation. We're also aware, of course, that there was a major finding of the EPA that was backed by the U.S. Supreme Court that basically said the EPA could regulate greenhouse gases because it was harmful to human health. And the Trump administration is now trying to repeal that, which could be the basis to repeal all climate regulations. Add anything to that, if you would, in terms of your level of concern about what we're seeing rolled back here.
Yeah, there definitely is a sort of back-to-back-to-back attacks on our environment, our rights, just anything that he can really strip away to keep the rich richer and the rest of us, you know, reaping the consequences of their actions, he will do it. I do like to put a big emphasis on his attacks towards renewable energy. This also coincides with the narrative that fossil fuel companies will put out and billionaires that are backing and investing into fossil fuel companies. They're spreading misinformation saying that it is more costly to implement green energy and renewable energies, which is completely false. If we're looking at the Lazard Annual Report on electricity generation, it concluded that renewables are the most cost-competitive form of generation, even without subsidies. The way they do this is they want to keep us overwhelmed, confused, and misinformed, because that's a big tool they use to keep control over us and to keep the money flowing. They care more about these short-term profits than they do about long-term profit. If we're also talking about, you know, his attack on, like, the Roadless Rule and the Marine Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, you know, like, it could be very overwhelming. They want us to be overwhelmed. It could be overwhelming for me, too. Like, even just talking about it, I'm like, wow, there's so many different things I want to cover. But, yeah, I think a really big one is the attack on renewable energies, because that really could be our next step to a greener future. You know, like, fossil fuel emissions are a huge contributor to the climate crisis.
That was Madison Shepherd, youth climate activist and lead organizer with Fridays for Future Cape Cod. Learn more about the Make Billionaires Pay International Mobilization for Climate Justice, September 19th through the 21st, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.